The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, May 5th, 2023. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Casual Friday with Alex Perrine, friend of the show. Meanwhile, another good month of job growth despite the Fed's labor discipline. The White House indicates it may be open to raising the debt limit for a shorter period of time as a stopgap. I don't know why they're doing these concessions already. The Republicans have no leverage. Anyway, more drip about Clarence Thomas and his corruption. Federalist Society activist Leonard Leo reportedly made secret payments to Ginny Thomas through Kellyanne Conway, billing a nonprofit, but said, don't put Ginny's name on the documents. The worst of the recent banking crisis may not be over. Shares of regional banks continue tumbling downward. Dianne Feinstein, I say that in bold quotes, tweeted yesterday, downplaying criticism that her prolonged absence for shingles since February is slowing down judicial nominees, which it is. Teamsters file an unfair labor practices complaint against Amazon over union busting. Trump testified in E. Jean Carroll's rape lawsuit, called her a, quote, whack job. Always classy. Whack job and nut job, both of them. And he said, repeated the, she's not my type thing. Like, no one believes that, dude. She's a blonde woman. Like, we know your type. It's pretty well documented. But not to be crass about it. Go E. Jean Carroll. Two mass shootings in 2 days in Serbia. And the Serbian president promises to ramp up gun control laws. Must be nice. The anti-trans bills that just passed through the Florida legislature would allow trans kids to be taken from their families if they receive care. Indiana signs its own anti-trans bill, specifically targeting care and women's sports. Women's sports, the biggest issue in America. Cinema and Tom Tillis work together to try to extend Title 42. Bipartisanship, baby. And lastly, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds says she'll allow, or she will sign a bill that allows children as young as 14 to work construction and demolition jobs. This is a big trend in this country right now. Child labor laws being overturned. All this and more on today's Majority Report. I'm sorry to everybody that was expecting Sam on this casual Friday. We were too, and we did just see him. But he's really not feeling well.
He was not well.
Not well. And he tried
to whatever vehicle he tried to get home in.
Yes. So he's got something up with his stomach. But wishing Sam well, making sure, you know, want him to be feeling better. He was here until like a half an hour ago and was up until the point, like, I can do this, and then he couldn't do it.
He always tries.
He always does try.
He's pretty relentless when it comes to that. He's like Cal Ripken. Like,
even when he maybe shouldn't try. Yeah. Maybe should have gave up.
We almost had to encourage him, like, please.
Yeah,
please
just,
go home.
I said, Sam, I can do it. It's okay. And he was like, I can do it. But you really can't sometimes tell, except, like, his level of hair disheveledness usually indicates
how badly
he's feeling. And it was a 10 today. So, no, Sam, feel better, Sam. we'll be speaking to Alex Perrine in a moment, but wanted to start with this. Drip, 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 drip. Every day we're hearing a new story. I mean, that sounds gross, but like, if you know what I mean. From a journalistic perspective, there's a lot coming out about Clarence Thomas and his just cartoonish corruption. I mean, in other countries, people go to prison for the kind of stuff that we're seeing coming out about Clarence Thomas. We can barely get a hearing. I was reminded by Ronald Reagan on Twitter the other day that we did get a hearing when I was out on Wednesday, but it was so unforgettable that I didn't even remember it. I'd completely forgotten about it.
Forgettable, not.
Because Dick Durbin, like, doesn't want to do his job.
Yeah, the most memorable thing that we talked about on Wednesday was, you know, former Bush Attorney General Michael Mukasey being like, you think I'd potentially sacrifice a beautiful friendship by refusing to go on a private jet?
Right.
I would never do that.
That's, again, I did remember that. That was some questioning from John Ossoff and, right, former Bush Attorney General there, basically saying that it would be very uncouth. I mean, Emily Post would not approve of turning down gifts.
It's not proper decorum.
Not proper. Again, it would be like stabbing Emily Post. That's how against manners it would be. Hilarious. I wish I had friends like this that just, you know, gave me millions of dollars on a whim or tens of thousands, as we're seeing in this instance on different channels, which is a way to hide and obscure the literal corruption that we're seeing right now. So, of course, Clarence Thomas, it's been over the past few weeks, discovered that Harlan Crow, the billionaire real estate club for growth benefactor, has given taken Clarence Thomas on yacht vacations, on his private jet, given him expensive historical memorabilia, including Frederick Douglass's Bible, among other things.
This is from ProPublica. Clarence Thomas had a child in private school. Harlan Crow paid the tuition.
That too.
And, you know, like,
ProPublica has been on this, by the way.
Pretty interesting that the left all of a sudden wants kids to take out student loans just because of who their parents are.
I know. I mean, Pell Grants or Harlan Crow. These are the institutions that America's decided are appropriate for funding people's education. But again, more keeps coming out. And now, since ProPublica's been on this, you get these legacy outlets like the Washington Post now doing some digging. And they found that Leonard Leo, who is a longtime Federalist Society bigwig, paid Ginny Thomas off the books, through Kellyanne Conway and a nonprofit there, specifically said, keep Ginny's name out of this. At least $80,000 that we know about. And at least one of the payments was through Kellyanne. Now, this was in around 2012, so like 10, 11 years ago. For me, this feels like money laundering, but we've legalized so much corruption in America that it's really just hard to tell. However, Kellyanne Conway went on TV yesterday. I guess this was on Fox News with Martha McCallum here, right?
Sorry, this was this morning. Actually.
Oh, this morning.
This is Dana Perino.
Dana Perino.
One
of the blonde women. Okay, I'm McCallum sorry.
Is coming up. That's why you were confused.
I'm not trying to racially profile her, but I get confused sometimes.
It's a carousel. Spin the wheel. Which one's coming?
All right. So one of the ladies.
Those stylists just do the same thing every time.
I mean, truly. Look, I'm not into fashion, but they all do this. It's the same makeup and same hair too.
Like, look at McCallum in the bottom corner and Perino.
That's what confused me.
Exactly.
Like the soft beachy waves, the intense contour eyeshadow, eyeliner, all that. Like I'm terrible at makeup, but I don't want to look
smoky.
Yeah, right.
It has to be house style. It has to be Fox house. Style.
Oh, of course, they definitely have somebody in house that does this, and like
she's mailing it in.
Also, the same person that does the fashion on The Bachelor, by the way, and the makeup. Anyway, so here we go. Kellyanne Conway was asked to respond this morning on Fox. Here it is.
But the Washington Post this morning then has this, if you could pull it up for it. It says, judicial activist directed fees to Clarence Thomas' wife and urged no mention of Ginny Thomas and that Leonard Leo told you, Republican pollster Kellyanne Conway, to build the nonprofit, then use the money to pay the spouse of Supreme Court Justice, but not put her name in it. I'll give you a chance to respond to that, because I've seen other networks this morning really covering this as if it's big, huge breaking news.
Sure.
What do you say?
Well, clearly I didn't watch any of that, but this is 2011, 2012, according to the Washington Post. Leonard Leo is quoting that article. I think it's an important quote. He says, "I've known the Thomases. They've been my friends since 1990, and I'm very mindful of how vicious and gossipy people can be, so I always try to protect their privacy and their safety." Viciousness from 10 years ago, 11 years ago, has turned into violence now, where people are outside of Supreme Court justices' homes trying to assassinate Justice Kavanaugh while his wife and daughters are sleeping in that home. So these people will stop at nothing. They want Clarence Thomas to resign so Joe Biden, of all people, can replace him with one of his own. In this case, Ginny Thomas was one of my contractors, and she had worked at the Heritage Foundation. She was part of the grassroots, She had worked in the Reagan administration. This is a serious person who for years worked in public policy. And at the polling company, we did public opinion research and data analytics. We had no business before the court. Mm-hmm.
But how do you feel about being dragged into this? I mean, your name is now a part of this.
You're no stranger to that.
They love it. I'm not a stranger to that. They love to put my name in a headline. Either Kellyanne Conway or Kellyanne Conway's husband seems to be on their favorite headlines. But the fact is this.
You know who doesn't want the name in the headline?
The Washington Post was looking for me all day yesterday.
Ginny Thomas.
I want to look them in the eye and tell them I'm aware that you contacted a lot of my former employees, and you asked, you suggested to one of them that you go to her home and look at her old emails. That is so beyond the pale, but that's who they are.
I mean, that sounds like good journalism.
Sounds like reporting.
Yeah, they called my former colleagues to verify this information. How dare they?
It is beyond the pale.
One little thing about the Harlan Crow, he's been friends since 1990. President George H.W. Bush nominated Thomas to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia in 1990. It's interesting. 1990, a big year for
October 23rd, 1991. Justice Thomas sworn in as a Supreme Court justice.
Wow, that's
interesting.
I mean,
when that
when it rains,
started.
It pours. You know, you're making a lot of new friends, yeah, and you're becoming one of the 9 most powerful judges in this country.
And you're putting pubes on pop cans.
It really is like what they say. You know, when you're dating, and then all of a sudden you have so many options, but it was so dry before. It's like that's what it's like with Clarence Thomas. He's just a hot commodity, I guess. Kellyanne leaves out the obvious issue here, which is the failure to disclose. I think all of this shit should be illegal. Payments going to our Supreme Court justices, but that's not even...
People being that rich.
Right. Or well, that too. I mean, Harlan Crow, yes. Should not be allowed to be a billionaire. There should be no billionaires. But besides that, by the letter of U.S. law... A lot of this is allowed, unfortunately, as long as you disclose it. The point is that this was a multi-decade effort to obscure and hide these kinds of payments. In 2004, the LA Times wrote about the relationship between Harlan Crow and Clarence Thomas, because Thomas had been disclosing some of that stuff at that point. As soon as that article came out, Thomas stopped disclosing the payments, the trips, the gifts. In this instance here, this is the lesson that Thomas learned and said, Ginny, just you can get paid, but just make sure it's off the books. And so Leonard Leo says, Kellyanne, we're going to make it look like this is through your consulting practice, but it's really going to Ginny Thomas, and keep her off the ledger.
And the idea that Ginny Thomas is a serious person, no, she's a lunatic, but she's very connected to the right wing not NGO, but think tank dark money movement. So it's actually a real problem that a Supreme Court justice's wife is taking payments and working with behalf of the Heritage Foundation and all these other things, which are frankly against American democracy.
Right. Exactly. I mean, she doesn't even buy her own BS here. She understands that she's got...
This is somebody who moves money for billionaires.
Yeah.
And it's I need to go... This is part of that job.
Right.
And so you need to perform for the PR purpose of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, wasn't that her job always?
Exactly.
Right. So let's not...
Gun for hire.
Exactly. All right, guys. Quick word from our sponsors before we get to Alex. Reminder, Mother's Day is coming up. This is your reminder to do something nice for your mom. And what you can do, I did this not for my mom, but for my dad. Storyworth is an online service that helps you and your loved ones connect through sharing stories and memories and preserves them for years to come. So it's hard to get gifts for people, I understand, but usually sentimental gifts, it's like the best way to go. People appreciate that more. It sticks with them more. And it's a way to stand out selfishly if you want your mom to be like, hey, or your grandma or your close friend or your wife to appreciate it. This is how Storyworth works. Every week, Storyworth emails a thought-provoking question of your choice from a vast pool of possible options. Each unique prompt asks questions you've never thought of, like, what's some of the best advice your mother gave you? Or, if you were to do it all over, what would you do differently? It's amazing reading someone's answers to these questions. You'll discover stories and memories you've never heard about and learn new things about stories you thought you knew. After 1 year, Storyworth compiles all those questions and stories, including photos, into a beautiful keepsake book for the whole family that the family can share for generations. Now, yeah, I mean, they ask you all kinds of questions that you wouldn't think to ask one of your relatives. I wish I did this and had like this option for some of my grandma, my relatives that passed, because they had such amazing lives that they're questions I never thought to ask them, and now I won't be able to. But you can do that through Storyworth, and it's a wonderful sentimental gift for someone in your life as well. It's these keepsakes, really, they are priceless, and it's a really thoughtful thing to do for one of the moms in your life. Give them a meaningful gift that you'll both cherish for years with Storyworth. Right now, for a limited time, you'll save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/majority. That's STORY worth, WORTH.com/majority to save $10 on your first purchase. Storyworth.com/majority. Do it now, because Mother's Day is coming up sooner than you think. And lastly, one of our favorite sponsors, Sunset Lake Sebede. Look at that. There we go. I'm covering it up. Sunset Lake Sebede. SunsetLakeSebede.com. Always, you can use the codes left is best to get 20% off. They're incredible products. There's a lot of junk Sebede out there, truly. This is not it. It's third-party tested. They use regenerative farming practices. I use it daily, really. The melatonin Sebede gummies are a go-to because I'm a tough sleeper. And it's one of the only things that really helps me that is, like, also not bad for me, too. So I really appreciate their product. I have been having, like, some skin stuff due to pollen and allergies. I've been using the salve a little bit on it and the lotion, too, which smells amazing. I like the scented stuff, but you can also get the unscented that Sam likes. There's the tinctures. There's the smalls that you can grind up and smoke it with your pot. Other stuff like that. It's really, really great products. So just don't go to a bodega and get stuff and waste your money. Seriously, go to sunsetlakesebede.com. Left is best, 20% off for the real good stuff. They're movement sponsors. They're wonderful people over there. We raised a ton of money with them over the 420 sale because we matched, or they did, and then we matched. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it was for the Last Prisoner Project, which is a great, great organization that helps people who have been convicted for cannabis, which is insane in this country, but it's still a reality. So they are a great company that you can feel good about supporting, and I can personally vouch for their products. Sunset Lake, Sebede.com, left is best is the code, and you get 20% off. All right, guys, going to take a quick break, come back. We'll be joined by Alex Breen.
We'll be right back.
are back, and we are joined by Alex Perrine of the AP, the good one, the politics of everything, all that stuff. Alex, thanks so much for coming on again, as always.
Yeah, of course. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you. We opened the show talking a bit about Clarence Thomas, but there's just so many different angles to this that we need to unpack. What's your reaction to first ProPublica getting a lot of these scoops here, and now we have the Washington Post getting in on the action? That's usually an indication that there's even more there to dig into when the legacy outlets start to build on top of what these other reporters have already uncovered. I mean, I would imagine this is an endless story of corruption, and the point is just, what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, and I think you're totally right on the meaning of the timeline in terms of how it's been reported here. You know, the press to a degree are pack animals, and you know, what I find kind of interesting is that we've had a small cycle of Clarence Thomas ethics stories about his finances get reported on more than a decade ago in 2011 that then sort of just got forgotten about. But I think that, you know, based on the way the story's unfolded so far, you're going to have a bunch of very dogged reporters with a lot of resources at their disposal now digging into this story. And I think to some extent, you always have to just ask, like, where were you for the last decade covering these things? But, you know, let's be grateful that now they're on it.
I know. But that's my reactions often too, right? But and also not for, I mentioned this earlier, but in 2004, the LA Times reported on the relationship between Harlan Crowe and Clarence Thomas.
Oh, that's right.
Because he was disclosing it at the time, and then he stopped.
And then he just stopped. That's right. Yeah. I forgot it went back that far, but yeah, that's right. But you know what you got to say, and just to be, I guess, mean spirited here, is that, like, this is what happens when, you know, the real reporters start digging into this stuff, and not the, like, Supreme Court correspondents who otherwise cover the court every day, you know, like Nina Totenberg at NPR or something, who, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg officiated her wedding, I think. But, like, I'm pretty sure that's correct. Yeah, yeah.
You're getting a nod from Bradley. I did not know that that was the person.
And she only disclosed that she was, like, close friends with Antonin Scalia after he died.
But yeah. Right.
And she's like, and NPR's brass has defended her tooth and nail as being, like, it's important to have those sources be friends with your reporter so you can get more inside material.
That might have been the only funny thing Elon did, was calling them state media. Go on.
Yes. No, exactly. Yeah, right. it goes to show that, you know, there's all this shit going on that could be reported at any time if the people would dig into it. But, like, the people whose job it is to cover this every day it's the limits of actual access journalism, which I'm sure your audience does not need to be told of the limits of that, but it's, like, on display now, you know, like, this is stuff that has it for a decade now, was there waiting for someone to uncover it,
right? And I also think Thomas's is just sloppier than everybody else.
Oh yeah, I'm sure, totally.
Like we have these little stories now coming out too about Gorsuch, right? What was that in 2015?
He had, like, sold land to a partner.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And did not disclose that, but on his disclosure forms, put down who gave him cowboy boots and who gave him, you know, other just, like, much smaller memorabilia. But curiously, leaves the part blank about who purchased his $1.8 million plot of land in Colorado, and then you find out it's some Republican-tied law firm. Like, but that stuff's been going on for a long time. It's just that Thomas is such a vicious ideologue, and he's so swampy and connected to these unsavory people who aren't that subtle about it, and part of it's his wife's connections as well, that it's that's the easier stuff to really sell to the public and hopefully delegitimize the court, honestly.
My impression is it's a couple things going on, one of which is that you can call Thomas sloppy, but I also think he's like
arrogant.
Arrogant, but also the one who sort of cares the least about propriety, or at least cares the least about following the letter of the law, so to speak, you know, because he doesn't have any respect for, you know, if someone reports on his financial dealings, he's like, I'm just going to stop doing disclosures. And like the savvy lawyerly thing to do is to do the Gorsuch thing of like, I'm going to disclose all this ticky tacky meaningless stuff and like kind of hide the real stuff. But for Thomas, it's just like, it's really much more of a screw you attitude where he's like, you know, these rules are meaningless to me. You can't touch me. I'm untouchable. I'm going to like do this much more grandly. But I also think like he might just be too the easiest to bribe because he's like the most nakedly greedy in a sense. Like, I think he had a quote in like 2001 where he was like, the money's not good enough for me to like be like put up with all this stuff on being on the Supreme Court, he meant. But yeah, I mean, I think that's two of the reasons why it's coming out about Thomas. And I think like we should also, you know, remember Antonin Scalia died at a mega donor's ranch or something like that. You know, what was he doing there? I don't know. I mean, he was having a good time. There's probably like all sorts of the stuff that either is waiting to be uncovered or like has just been treated as normal up until now.
Part of it is also, I would say, that the mechanisms of corruption for the court on the right just don't exist on the left. I mean, I know that Ketanji Brown Jackson has recused herself from that Chevron doctrine case. Bradley, is that the case she recused herself from? And we don't really know what that's about, but that's something that I can guarantee the thread that connects her to the Chevron case that's a little problematic is a lot shorter or thinner or whatever you want to visualize than Clarence Thomas ruling and refusing to recuse himself on the case involving his literal wife.
Right.
I mean, like, there's a completely different standard for right-wing justices on the court in terms of impropriety. And that's partly because the Federalist Society and the robust financial backing for these extremist right-wing judges, there's no equivalent for Democrats right now.
Yeah, and that's one of the more important stories to take away from the Washington Post story on Leonard Leo arranging these payments to Ginni Thomas. Is that it all stems from this we take care of our own mentality on the right, where they have, I mean, more donor money than they know what to do with, all of it sloshing around mysterious you know, nonprofits and PACs and you know, I think the place that ended up giving Ginni this money was, you know, basically like had a generic name and a lot of like money from undisclosed donors, and its address was a UPS store.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's part of this entire, you know, financial infrastructure on the right, where they take all of this donor money and they use it to just sort of like take care of their guys. And we saw this with, you know, whoever retired Kavanaugh's debts and all this other stuff. Like, we don't, mm-hmm. still don't know that. But, you know, on the left wing version of that is like, when you give Chelsea Clinton a job on the Today Show or something. Like, I don't, you know, there's like the liberal version of that is just like,
Hunter Biden with the that like that small time, you know, oil Burisma company.
And he had to go out.
But that's so standard for any big politician's kid.
And he had to like go out hustling on his own to like organize that stuff too, right? Like when he wanted to trade on his dad's name, he like had to go out and work for it. You know, it wasn't like
bootstraps theory for Nepo kids.
It wasn't like Clarence Thomas's grandnephew or whatever that kid was.
His quote son, who Harlan Crow paid his entire tuition for. Now, I mean, back to just like the Democrats and their role in this here. Did you see that Dianne Feinstein tweeted?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
I mean, Dianne Feinstein tweeted,
right.
Is it a Weekend at Bernie's situation where they just put her phone in front of her so they can get through, like, you know, the face recognition and then they tweet, or does she give them the login? Does she even remember the login? Like, she's been out since February with shingles, and she's saying that there's been no holdup in judicial nominations, which is just not true. It's just not, like... I mean, before Sam left this morning, we were talking a bit about it. There's a holdup in nominations going into the committee now. Like, ones that have already gone through, they don't really need her vote. But they really do need her on the Judiciary Committee. She's the number two Democrat on the Judiciary Committee. And Dick Durbin's like, yeah, you know, she'll get here when she gets here.
Yeah. It was a little tweet thread. I assume that means that she finally remembered her password. Maybe that's been the problem for the last few months.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, I mean, it was, I don't know. I reading the statement, I was just, all I could ask myself was, who is this meant to convince? Who is this aimed at, and who is it meant to convince? Like, anyone who has been paying attention to what's been going on with judicial nominations will not read that statement and come away thinking, well, it seems like everything's under control. You know, it's I don't know. It really was just, I don't know, it was kind of a attempt, I guess, by the staff that are puppeteering her, essentially, to deflect blame or something. And I noticed it like ended with like, you know, it's a real shame that, you know, Republicans are blocking these other nominations, which, like, I don't know, there's this tendency to among really annoying Democrats to say, like, well, why do people always blame us for not doing anything and not go after the Republicans? And it's like, because we assume that the people who work for California's Democratic senator would like want Joe Biden to have judges confirmed, you know, like, we just assume that you would have the same goals, that you would be aligned in that, and you would understand that like your current actions are the thing standing in the way of that. It's completely indefensible. So I don't know what else they could have done. It was just sort of, you know, it was just a pretty pathetic attempt.
Well, okay. So you mentioned the people that work for her. This is all speculation, obviously. And I've just heard a lot of people saying, and I don't have the understanding of what like the career dynamics are with staffers in Washington, but like, it's not far-fetched for me to imagine that there's an incentive for them to keep her in office as long as possible for their careers to advance. Like, I mean, where are the people around her and why are they doing anything?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so that's what you have to, that's what you have to remember, is that, Feinstein resigning doesn't just mean, you know, all the people who work for her will go on to get other jobs. But like right now, the people in that office are an acting U.S. senator. Like they can't, they don't have the warm body there right now to like press the vote button. But that's all Feinstein is a warm body to press the vote button. It's the people in that office are the ones who actually are, you know, doing the work of being a senator. And for her to resign would mean for them to have to give that up and be replaced by presumably a person who can, you know, actually do the work themselves. So it's asking them to give up power that they have accrued over a long amount of time. You know, more so than it is asking them to, you know, like worrying about them losing their jobs or something like that. But I don't know. I think what I find to be kind of really concerning about this is that, you know, however bad her condition is, you know, we've had senators show up basically, you know, like Strom Thurmond would be wheeled out, not a thing going on up in his head, but they would wheel him out on the floor to make votes at the end of his life. And if they can't even really manage that with Feinstein, then I mean, I don't know. I cannot imagine that we're like close to her being able to return at any time soon.
And here's another wrinkle to this. Biden not saying anything on this is getting more and more frustrating by the day, given the fact that in his first 2 years, he was really deliberate and outpaced Trump in these judicial nominations, which is key to our democracy, as we're seeing with the attacks on abortion rights, trans-affirming care, what have you. Is he worried that speaking about her decline undercuts his 2024 presidential ambitions?
I mean, I'm sure that has to be part of it. You know, I think part of it is the sort of, you know, the Senate, you know, the deference senators have, the fact that it's just like not done that you criticize your fellow senator, and Biden still sticks to that.
Yeah, he's still got the Senate congeniality, a tapeworm or whatever.
Yeah, and I'm sure that there's this thought that I remember you know, would hear this sometimes a little bit about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but I'm sure that there's a thought of like, you know, the more people who say she should resign, the like harder it is to get her to do it. But I don't think she's making these choices for herself anymore at this point. So I don't really buy that one.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, I'm sure you're right I think it undercuts his message to suggest that anyone is too old to continue serving in political power.
Right. And I mean, I from a political perspective, I see why you would be concerned about that. For him, though, there's been like a disconnect with how the public responds to him in poll numbers, and also what potentially his electoral chances are, because the Republican Party is so vile. And I can't believe that we're nearing the halfway point of the calendar year 2023 ahead of a 2024 presidential race. And there is no discernible angle that they have coalesced behind against Biden. And it looks more and more like Trump's going to be the nominee. And this is gift wrapped for a guy that does not have a ton of celebrity behind his presidency or hype, I guess. Like, it's just it's something unlike I've ever seen in my lifetime in observing politics. Not, you know, I know I'm just 29, but still, or any historical analog that I can think of.
Yeah, I mean, it's a I don't know, it's a bizarre race, especially because it does look like it'll be a rematch, which is pretty rare. You know, but it's bizarre for a lot of the reasons you just said, I think. You know, the incumbent I think is, you know, just, I mean, very few incumbent presidents decline the decision to run again. That hardly ever happened. So it's not exactly,
it's a huge advantage.
Even, and even if even if Biden himself was like halfway thinking he would be a one term president back when he was running before, I think the second you get into the gig, you throw that idea out the window, especially because 4 years like is actually doesn't seem like it's that much time. And when you're thinking like, oh, I have so much to do. But yeah, I mean, what's strange is that it's like, yeah, as you say, there's not a ton of, mass popular affection for the incumbent, but I think he's still the favorite, especially if it just ends up being a rematch again. And on the other side, on the Republican side, you know, I still don't see a viable path. If Trump manages to like run again and just do so halfway competently, I don't really see he'd have many of the advantages of incumbency, and I don't really see like I also think that they would rig the, for example, like people, his supporters would like rig the primaries for him if they had to.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably an under, you know, I know they've been talking about messing up the debate calendar for him, but like, they probably will go further than that if he asks it of them, you know?
I mean, I agree with you. It's also interesting that, well, maybe not interesting, maddening is a better word, but something to keep track of, that Joe Manchin is struggling to find a path forward politically at this point because his poll numbers are in the toilet in West Virginia, and Jim Justice is going to run against him as a Republican, and he's pretty popular.
Yeah.
And so the Republican who just puts on the blue hat and says, but I'm still agree with all Republicans, we see this time and time again. The Democrat who acts like a Republican often loses to the Republican, especially when you're in a red state like West Virginia. But Manchin saying, maybe I'll run as a third party for president, because he doesn't seem to have a future right now within the few avenues that being a West Virginia politician allows him in this current moment.
If I was advising Manchin, I'm serious. If I was advising him and all I cared about was his career, I would just tell him to trade jobs with Jim Justice. Like, that seems like the only way forward. Like, wouldn't help the rest of us to lose him in the Senate. Wouldn't help the rest of us, but because you're right, he's in an impossible bind. You know, like he's got to. He's already associated with the sort of toxic brand of the Democratic Party in the eyes of voters in West Virginia, but he's not going to be able to distinguish himself both from his party and from the Jim Justice style Republicans. It's going to be an impossible tightrope to walk unless he becomes an entirely different kind of politician. So I don't know what he's going to do. I know his instincts usually suck. I mean, I say that like he's won elections, so they're not always terrible. But he hasn't seemed like he has known exactly, you know, I would say since the beginning of the Biden administration, he's been all over the map in terms of like which direction he's tacking. So I think he's a little bit lost.
I think so, too. But I guess we will have to see. He and Sinema, honestly, are struggling to brand themselves just because this kind of politician is not what people want anymore. The donors want it, but he does. But people we've moved past this as a society, I think, to a certain degree.
Yeah, and you know, I think you know, there's a better case to be made that. There's definitely a better case to be made that the voter, or at least certain voters, want a Manchin figure than a Sinema figure, right? Because, like, as infuriating as some of Manchin's political choices can be, it certainly makes some political sense to be like, I'm a maverick against my own party in a place where Democrats are that unpopular. But for Sinema, I mean, it's I don't know. I think that I think it's pretty clear that she's like ditched the Democratic Party just to like become the official candidate of crypto or something. Like, who knows?
Yeah, of the Chamber of Commerce too. She's one of their favorites. Let's pivot to what's happening in our city here with the horrific killing of Jordan Neely. We covered this extensively yesterday on the show. It was one of the most difficult days for me, at least, ever covering a major story like this. I think part of what's so hard to sit with is I feel that the general reaction from more people than I would expect, or that maybe my brain allows me to believe exist, are defending this killing of a man in extreme mental and emotional distress who was having a mental health episode on the subway, who was choked out for, now it's 15 minutes, and there were multiple stops. You could have gotten off the car, you could have waved to a cop. There's all these cops on the subway platforms now. I know there are cops at Broadway Lafayette, where, like, I think a lot of this was happening. I know that because I was there the other day. There's always cops around there. Like, ask for help. But that wasn't what occurred to anybody in that situation. It's just baffling to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of the most... one of the most disturbing stories that I can remember happening here, for exactly the reasons you just said. The widespread, not even necessarily full-throated defenses, but this widespread, sort of idea that, that, you know, what happened was in some way, I guess, defensible or understandable. I find it repellent. I think it goes to show a couple things. One of which is that, people have been primed by years now of really, really scummy and hysterical media coverage. People have been primed to think of, unhoused people and certain people with mental illness as being basically threats that need to be dealt with.
If you're black.
Particularly if you're black, yeah. But I think that there's been a dehumanization of... widespread dehumanization of the homeless in particular, that has happened, in part because it's sort of, politically convenient for a government, class that can't actually address the problems that lead to homelessness. And so if you turn the people suffering from those problems, if you turn them into monsters, or threats, people who need to be swept up and dealt with, that makes it not your responsibility to actually, address the problems that led them there. I think that we have been completely warped by the treatment of, this is not relevant in this legally, but I think in terms of the mentality that led to this, we've been warped by years of these sort of stand your ground style laws, to think that, unleashing violence on a stranger can be acceptable in certain circumstances, but those circumstances do not have to include sort of a direct threat to your life, but just like a feeling that something could go wrong. And I think that's like that's sort of a real, you know, if anything, it's like a sort of cop attitude that has trickled down to regular people. You know, my discomfort in a situation could mean I'm at risk. And if I am potentially at risk, I have the license to do anything I want to another person. I think that these are completely nutty, nutty beliefs. But I think we're seeing that they've really, really taken hold among a lot of people.
Yeah. And I mean, I was shocked to see a lot of like backlash to our commentary, at least particularly mine, on the cesspool that is Twitter these days. And I think there's like a particular thing about it that triggers it when it comes from a woman, because like there's all these right wing cowboy fantasies about protecting women from like rape and assault and stuff like that, that I think is triggering for them. And they want to feel like they are the guardians of the civilized people in these situations, and that they too can be Liam Neeson in everyday life. And it's the othering that you describe. It's the demonization of poor people. And I think that we've hit this kind of inflection point in tough on crime culture war discourse, where it's gone so far with outlets like The Post and suburban moms reading true crime or listening to true crime, and dads reading, you know, right wing tabloids that have all these fantasies, contributing to this homeless demonization, where most people that I speak to who actually live in cities don't have the perspective that is so dominant right now in this Jordan Neely story. It's
right.
That's usually coming from people not living in the cities. And look, I grew up outside the city, and I do see that difference now that I've lived here for some years. So it's like this suburban titillation and demonization and fear that it's at a fever pitch right now.
Well, yeah, and I think what you have to remember, I think you touched on a lot of important things there, and one of them is the right-wing violence fantasy typically involving the patriarch defending, you know, women or the family from the barbarians and the hordes, basically. Like, that's a really important, that's a fundamental and important right-wing fantasy. And it's only sort of intensified over the last several years in terms of its salience, I think, on the right, because they've been thinking, I think, essentially since Obama took office, that they've been getting increasingly Charles Manson-y in their beliefs about, you know, race and crime and what's going on in the cities. Right. And then I think that there's the part of it that is a widespread, I think sometimes intentional, but often more accidentally revealing than intentional, conflation of safety and what I've been calling comfort, right? Which is like, if you see something that makes you feel uncomfortable, you turn it into a threat to your safety. And it doesn't actually matter, you know, it can be, teenagers smoking weed in public, which is no threat to you whatsoever, but that can become a symptom of lawlessness and disorder. It can become, you know, a person seemingly suffering from some sort of mental illness in public, who is more a threat to themselves than they are to anyone else, but becoming another symptom of disorder and possible threat to you. I think that this probably has sort of existed in the reactionary mind for a very long time, but it does seem like it's grown in salience over the last few years. This complete disinterest in any distinction between again, like, quote unquote order and actual safety.
Yeah. Matt, you wrote something here, but I can't elaborate
on it. It was in TJ Maxx. There's that other story too, where that guy just assumed that, I think two black girls, leaving the store were stealing the stuff in their bags and attacked them seriously, and they weren't even accused of actually stealing anything.
Yeah, and which is, again, if you, I guess, come to see yourself as, you know, the defender of order, in some insane way, that would make sense to you to do that. But it's like that the person you're talking about was not actually like a TJ Maxx employee. Right. It was just like just a person, guy. Right? Yeah. Just a guy. And that's nutty. Right. And the idea of,
and also protecting, like, it's one thing to be like, I'm a vigilante to protect the other people on the subway car. Again, reprehensible, whatever. But how much of a cuck do you have to be like, I need to protect
loss prevention.
Maxx. Like,
yeah,
I'm the property protector for things that aren't even my property. Rittenhouse syndrome.
I'm the Punisher, but for Dwayne Reed deodorant.
Honestly, it's just truly psychotic belief.
But I'm curious, like, Alex, like, the long perspective on this, because, like, you know, I watch Death Wish, and you know, I'm like, how does a society get to the point where this is a Hollywood film? And it's like, oh, this is exactly how.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, that association, I mean, it's a long one, that association of like the cities with disorder and all of it being heavily racially coded. And that does go back to, I mean, you know, maybe it goes back to when the Irish arrived or something, but like in our modern context, it goes back to the '60s and it goes back to white flight and you know, the growth of suburbia and all these things. But what I find really interesting is you know, the that Dirty Harry fantasy, I don't know, it seemed to weirdly, if anything, gain more salience in the real world as our actual cities for the most part became richer and more neoliberal and crime actually fell. So I don't know. I find that to be a really weird kind of, because, you know, exaggerated or not, there was more disorder in the cities back then than there is now.
Right.
So it certainly is odd that these attitudes have, if anything, strengthened over the last few years.
Well, Alex, thank you for coming on. Thank you for your time. Thank you the hearty laugh in the story where we needed it about...
Yeah.
What was the Punisher before Dwayne Reed deodorant? I'm going to steal that one.
I like a guy encouraging Dwayne Reed to take the glass cases down and be like, I got this, guy.
Yeah, right. I'm the patrol.
The next Marvel superhero, the Dwayne Reed Punisher.
Yeah. I mean, Ben Shapiro, maybe he wants to snag that IP for his production company. Appreciate you, Alex, always.
Yeah,
always love talking to you. It's the AP, the Substack, right? Mm-hmm. The Politics of Everything, the show that you do with the New Republic.
That's right. And I've been doing some work for Defector.com, too, for all you
Right,
fans
and writing on Popula and Defector. Oh, gosh. I mean, Bradley is, like, the number one cheerleader of the Defector. He loves it. And I love everything that's written there, too.
Oh, yeah.
So
no,
it's such a great site.
And basically a co-op. Like, it's like...
Worker-owned. Yeah.
All right.
Great
model. Support
and tell Sam to get well soon.
I will. I'll send those well wishes his way. Appreciate it, Alex. Have a good one, dude.
All right, you too.
Bye. All right. That is it for the first hour of this program. We're going to head into the fun half. I know it's Friday, but, you know, we had to move some things around. So just a short casual Friday episode now. The number is 646-257-3920. We will be taking your calls, reading your IMs, and more. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Left Reckoning, we talked to a comedian prankster, Chris James, about how he pranks people, who is now going kind of viral because he pranked Alex Jones with Tucker Carlson's voice.
Oh, we'll be AI. Talking about that in the fun half too.
And if you want if you want to hear Chris before he went sort of viral and A, won a lot of subscribers to his channel, and B, won a lot of anxiety because of all the attention. You can check that out at Left Reckoning this weekend, talking with Cuba, Deep State Cuba from This Revolution, about Ukraine and Russia.
That's so awesome that you got him on. That story's like crossing past our, because I've had people who, you know, aren't in our world reaching out about it. Like, oh man, it's going to drop on Monday, this call with Alex Jones. That's
yeah, and like, and he's also anxious because it's like he's worried that it's not going to live up to the hype. But I've been a Chris James fan for like half a decade now. His show where he regularly gets these people on the phone and does stupid things, like, you know, in this case, send Tucker Carlson's voice at Gorka in a way that he reacts to in a way that he seems to be embarrassed by. We'll have to see. Yeah, I love it. So patreon.com is just Left Reckoning.
I imagine it's gonna be really good given how freaked out Alex Jones is right now.
So apparently, like, what he does is with these AI voices, and we talked to him about using AI voices on Tuesday, is like Mike Huckabee is instead Mike Fuckabee, and he's very like lewd and vulgar and talks about like potty humor and stuff a lot, really gross out stuff. And so he used the AI Tucker voice to like be that, like say these very surreal but gross, either body or sick and disgusting things. And Alex just ran with it as if that's a normal way that Tucker interacts with him. So it's kind of revealing of their relationship maybe
it's pretty shallow.
Yeah. Like there's some LBJ tapes where LBJ will like imply like, hey, let's go have an affair, and it's shocking to hear, but it's also like, oh, these elite people, like, they talked like that a lot around at the time, like this is just part of their culture. they were actually like all having affairs anyway. That's what the Alex Jones things reminds me of, is like they're all sickos actually. Even when you think you're pranking them, they're like, well, this is par for the course,
right? On ESPN, we spoke about the results of the NFL draft. Who won? Who lost? Lots of hockey talk. The incredible play of Matthew Tkachuk, now a top five player in the NHL. I mean, this is an unbelievable run. I cannot believe that the Leafs lost two in a row at home.
Two in a row. Panthers again, up 2-0.
They are
beating better rivals seemingly at home. It's nuts.
I'm rooting for them to win the cup because for them to be unreal. The lowest seed in the East and do this, this is an incredible run. And we talked to Steph Curry and more. YouTube.com/ESPN show. All right, heading into the fun half. See you there.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, going to take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
That guy might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.